Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
Wonderful to be with you. Looking forward to our discussion. The text we're following this week, something like Pentecost 15. It's the Sunday closest to September 14th. We're all beginning in this part of the hemisphere a new academic year. So that might account for some of us having a slightly more frazzled tone. But we're following bits of the Genesis narrative, a tiny section in which the reconciliation is conceived as a possibility in the Genesis 50 passage. We're also following in the Hebrew scriptures the great narrative from the point of view of the whole of the Hebrew Bible of the stretching out of Moses' hands over the sea and the deliverance of the Israelites by the Lord and the passing of the Israelites through the sea. It's a narrative of deliverance, of victory. It's not for everybody, of course. It's not for the Egyptians. But in Israelite traditions, it's played an absolutely pivotal role, especially in liberation theology. And if you ever have the opportunity, I'm looking right now at a text of the Hebrew Bible in which the narrative of the song itself, which is not quite the narrative of Exodus 14, 19 to 11, but it is in the lectionary choices, which is a response of Exodus 15, the song of the sea. The Hebrew text of the Song of the Sea, in some editions of the Hebrew Bible, is set up to visualize the two sides, the two walls of the sea on either side of the page of the text, and the central text being smaller in the middle. So the visual image of the walls of the water is in the layout of the Hebrew text, and the Israelites are these little trickles, as it were, and the song, the narrative song of deliverance, passes through the middle of the walls of water. It's the only time it happens in the Hebrew Bible in these texts, and it's really striking. It's really striking. So we can talk a little bit about Exodus 15, the Song of the Sea, attributed to Miriam in subsequent interpretation, although Moses is credited with the song itself in Exodus 15. The psalm, "Bless the Lord, O my soul," is a song of praise. And of course, it's got to do with deliverance. Verse 4, "The Lord redeems your life from the grave and crowns you with mercy and loving kindness." And so this celebration is part of now the narrative of deliverance for the Israelite slaves. Romans 14, the epistle in the New Testament, is part of a two-chapter discussion of the weak and the strong groups, two groups at least, that can be identified either by Paul or already in Rome as part of the makeup of maybe several or at least one congregation there. Those people, some of them who are identified as weak, eat only vegetables, and the strong eat anything. We were discussing this in our church Bible study yesterday, and we are following Beverly Gaventa's commentary on When in Romans. It's a great title. But of this chapter, she says, "Lettuce eaters are those who are weak in faith, and garbage bellies are those who eat everything." So we had fun discussing that. The principle here, I think, is line 2. Who are you to pass judgments on servants of another, slaves of another? Because God has welcomed all. This is Romans 14, verse 4. Gospel. The gospel is about forgiveness. It's in a chapter about community practices and even regulations of community. Remember, this is a gospel. This is chapter 18 of Matthew's gospel. And in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, the community has already started to pray the Lord's Prayer, which has very clear stipulations on forgiveness. If I could just point out one that I've always found very helpful. We will forgive others as we have been forgiven, as we have been forgiven. So the injunction to forgive has been part of the narrative Jesus teaches in Matthew's gospel. So this section of chapter 18 is just a way of looking at the same issue from a different perspective. It's how slaves treat each other. So it's conceptualized as members of the Matthean community. And the last line, so will my heavenly Father hand you over to be punished or to be imprisoned if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart. So those are some odd thoughts about the readings for today. What would you like to pick up on?
If I could enter an interstices, I know persons who are going to preach from this in particular will choose one of the tracks to work with rather than the other. But then there are also teachers and public proclaimers who might be influenced by the readings from the lectionary who might consider both sets of readings in one. I don't know if that's a realistic portrayal. But the theme of forgiveness is so strong in the Matthean reading. This theme of accommodation and tolerance is so present both are present in the Romans. Mm-hmm. That when I look at both sets of readings, neither acceptance or forgiveness, neither is a total fit in both tracks.
Right.
Overall. But there are elements of both in each. But then when I look at Exodus 14, 19 to 31, it's so much part of a retributive narrative that it is really very incredibly tense in its juxtaposition with the narratives of forgiveness and tolerance. And that I ponder. What end, I'm not sure, but it leaves me curious.
Mm-hmm. Josh.
Yeah, I suppose that I'm interested in what judging means, like drilling down on what it means to not judge another here. I understand the forgiveness and but exactly what is involved. I mean, obviously we do make judgments about, and we see this throughout the New Testament, judgments about behavior, certain behavior in others. But in our culture, we tend to think that, you know, a conclusion about someone's behavior or someone's acts or something like that is a judgment. What is this? It doesn't seem to me to be saying avoid drawing any conclusions, any moral conclusions about anything. I suppose is what I mean. Does that question make sense?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it's in this Romans passage. It's judgment is made on the grounds of things that are in fact adiaphora.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, they're not important.
Mm-hmm.
It's not important what you eat, whether it's one thing or another thing, because there are much more important issues at stake. And the more important issues at stake are the welcoming by God of all the people in the community of Romans. So, who are you, says Paul in line 2 of our lectionary set mm-hmm. out. Who are you to pass judgments on servants of another? In other words, you are, as I am, says Paul in Romans 1, slave of God.
Mm-hmm.
We are all slaves of God, and we belong in the households of God. In fact, the Greek says in the word it translated servants, it's the Greek word for household slave, household mm-hmm. slave, which I suppose is a slightly better category of slavery, but it's still slavery. Mm-hmm. So it's a way by which we can see that Paul, like, say, his contemporary Stoics, who would also make an assessment that there are things that are adiaphora, that is to say, passions, those are insignificant, and things that are much more important, and those are Stoic virtues, Stoic dispositions, you know, of self-sufficiency, rationality, reason, logic, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. That may not be what you're getting at, Josh, but it's into that context that the word judgment and judging exists in Romans.
Yes, I was going to agree that it does address my concern. There's almost something like you're setting yourself up in the position of the master,
yep.
or something
yep.
like that.
Yeah,
and there seems to be the assumption that permission has been given, and you are telling yourself. Like permission has been given on this and you are telling them that they don't have permission or something like that. Anyway, sorry,
yep.
Althea.
No, I'm agreeing with you that I think Nietzsche's response is helpful. It narrows it down and it sort of creams off a number of other things, like a final judgment, that exacts some kind of expectation of punishment of a kind. And it makes it, what I heard as Deirdre spoke was about how you, what are the terms under which you esteem each other? Mm-hmm. How do you avoid that kind of evaluative behavior that can lead to derision and scorn and reduce or diminish the capacity for shaping a robust fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
That yeah. goes beyond just the definition, but it includes attitudes and impacts.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
What for focusing on Romans 14, though, I found myself, what did you call it? What did she call it? Beverly Gaventa called it the garbage group?
Yeah, garbage bellies.
Garbage bellies. That sounded so much like me.
lettuce eaters. And I prefer lotus eaters, but it's lettuce. Lettuce eaters. and garbage bellies.
I'm all for let us eat.
Well, it's a robust description. What do we say? Right.
Is that a literal translation?
No. Well, Beverly is a New Testament scholar.
Right. But
I should say it's a more a paraphrase.
You know, okay.
Yeah. It's because the NRSV chooses vegetables. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Vegetables or eating anything. So, but it's unforgettable. And in the discussion yesterday, the church group I was trying to meet, moderate, was very taken with it.
Paraphrase with a bit of embellishment.
I mean, God doesn't care. Is what Paul is saying. God doesn't care about eating practices. So some people in the group yesterday said, yes, but this must be, you know, this must be controversial for Jews, you know, who keep kosher food laws and so on and so on. And I was making the point that, well, Paul is on his way to Rome to make the case. I mean, unfortunately, he dies before he gets there, as far as we know. But this is the preface to his argument that he will try and make in Rome. And presumably it's building on the gospel proclamation of other people, and it may or may not be successful. What happens in Romans is a kind of a sort of casting your bread upon the waters. You know, these are my arguments about this and this, and then you see what you can do when you're there in person and how persuasive these arguments might be.
Yeah. I wonder what, you know, that first portion, about eating anything or eating only vegetables and tolerating, living with each other and not passing judgment or condemnation on each other for life practices. That functions at such a, those terms are associated with life, survival, nutrients, what we need to do. But those nutrients, what we choose to eat, are also, I think, indicative of aspects of a culture or group to which we belong. They're, in a sense, identity markers. I can only assume, and it's quite an imagination on my part, that one could see a Jewish vegetarianism as part of a covenant understanding of what God requires of them, versus Gentiles I don't mean to say the Israelites were only vegetarian, but I, over and against Gentiles who were coming in from other kinds of religious practices, where the burning of meat before the deity preceded the eating of that same meat. So their metonymic capacity is something that makes me wonder, especially because then we go on to talk about days. Who prefers one day over another day? And that, it's very easy to think that the day that's being observed is a Sabbath day.
Yes, but absolutely.
Also include holidays and holy days coming from different groups, you know, that Dionysian convert coming into this community might have different notions about what kind of days should be observed and how. And certainly Jews coming into that community would also have very, very strong opinions about observing days.
I agree.
The bringing together of disparate practices is implicit in Romans 13.
I don't know if it helps at all to think of the Roman communities to whom Paul is writing as somewhat fragile. I think it helps, and I try to argue that when Paul says in Romans 13, which is just the prior chapter, let every person, 13:1, be subject to the governing authorities, it's not an absolute principle. It may be to shore up a fragile set of house communities in the capital of the Western Mediterranean world, and not an eternal principle. That's all I was trying to say.
And when you use the word fragile, my mind runs in all kinds of directions. So to tidy me up, say some more about how you're thinking about community fragility.
Well, dissension foments fragility. And at the same time, if the community is fragile, it's easy to argue, because the anxiety is displaced. The anxiety about survival is displaced onto community members. I mean, that was all I was thinking about. I was trying not to say that there is an eternal principle in Romans 13, which is that every person should be subject to the governing authorities because they're over God. That's what I was saying. I was thinking that they were in Rome. The situation is they're in Rome. You know, they're not in, you know, the end of Turkey. You know, they're not far from Rome. They're right in Rome. And they may be, you know, dealing with political power on a far closer basis than any other community that Paul knows. So sort of keep your heads down, that kind of thing.
Yeah. A long and old discussion that you brought to mind as you talked about it is John Becker's discussions of Paul in terms of contingency and coherency. Can you find a coherent theology across Paul's letters? And I think he argued for, if I'm remembering him right, he argued for contingency and contextualization of the letters. And that sounds very much like what you're saying there, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. in some aspects there's not an eternal principle. It's likely that obeying the governing authorities is one of those non-eternal principles, not an absolute injunction. And so it points to, and the querulousness points to the fragility within the community. So I'm also positing a twofold fragility without being immediately able to say this is how it fits with Romans 14. But the internal community fragility is one thing. And if they're in Rome, then they're in the heart of the empire.
Yep.
You know, the need for them to find compatibility and ways of living with each other becomes really very, very critical when you're in the heart of the empire, because the consequences could also be significant for the goals of the movement, even possibly the lives of the people in the movement. So that fragility has to be addressed.
You know, in Romans 16, he only identifies one church, one community in someone's house, the house of Prisca and Aquila. And even if he identifies a lot more people, and we might imagine that there are other communities, it's nevertheless looking like a very small set of people that he wishes to visit. And in 15, I mean, he's basically saying, I really hope to get to you. I've been hindered from getting to you. And what I need when I get to you is to be sent on by you, 15:24, with a tiny bit of support as your kind of symbolic allegiance to Gentile communities or Gentile Jewish communities, whose offerings I will take to Jerusalem and from where I will then go on to Spain. It's possible to see it not as grandiose at all, but yeah, fragile.
A tactical measure.
Yeah.
It still is a strange thing to say. I mean, the whole letter is in many ways an extended argument about Jesus as the Kurios, right? and they're in Rome where there is quite clearly a Kurios other than Jesus. So you have to parse what this means, because there that whole community is about acknowledging Jesus as Lord.
Yep.
And the implication being that's not Caesar. So it's I definitely think that you can't read that aspect of Romans 14 without recognizing that larger context. I mean, it's a clear contrast, it seems to me, but I don't know exactly what to make of it always. So yep. I mean, right, he says in this passage that we're reading here, every knee will bow to him, right?
He does. Exactly. I was just looking at that. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not sure Caesar wants to hear that.
Right, exactly.
No.
That's exactly the kind of thing that can get you stamped out. It's the kind of thing that gets Jesus killed. They killed him, right? So it could be tactical in that sense. Like, don't cause trouble. You know, don't bring the wrath of Rome down on your head or something like that. But what does all that mean? What are the implications of that?
It's just a big tension between reading New Testament texts as first century texts, mm-hmm. as opposed to fourth century Holy Roman Empire texts, mm-hmm. which is, as we all know, a tension that is almost impossible to live with.
Mm. Yeah, as first century texts, they have not yet. They're still centuries away from that convergence between Rome and the Christian movement.
Yeah.
And which is, this does not presage that convergence, not in terms of the discussion that we're having about it. Because if you contextualize them in the larger Roman Empire, in the heart, the seat of empire, then what Josh is pointing to is that this language about Jesus as Lord is actually a countervailing force. It's not. It signals just to have this Lord sort of back in Matthew, mm-hmm. when Jesus was born, to have this Lord is to actually be in the face of the secular and political Lord who has the might. It's not only that the kingdom of God is at stake, it's not just that the faith is at stake. They are at stake in such a situation. But the bigger thing, I'm interpreting your bigger thing, Deirdre, the mm-hmm. bigger thing, bigger than who eats what and who observes what day, mm-hmm. is this establishment of a way of living together that is not governed by the major or minor conflicts of the empire, but governed by how you understand what this Lord, this other Lord, expects of you.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I said that we all are agreeing that Paul is writing to people in Rome, I was in the back of my mind thinking about Revelation. Because in Revelation, which after all is also a canonical text, in Revelation 13, we get the opposite of Romans 13. So Romans 13 says, be subject to the governing authorities because they're from God. And Revelation 13 describes a beast rising out of the sea. 10 horns, 7 heads, mm-hmm. and its mouth it's got power from the dragon. Its mouth is like a lion's mouth. And guess who worships the beast? Everybody worships the beast except for the community. So this is Rome. This is Rome. Rome mm-hmm. demands obeisance. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible to have a lot more guts in the New Testament and talk about Rome from the borders of Turkey. That's why I was there, you know, off Turkey in a little island called Patmos. Mm-hmm. It's possible to have more guts by getting out of Rome and, you know, being offshore and imagining these apocalyptic descriptions of the beast from the sea and the beast from the land, both of which are Rome, and the terrible effects, and the dragon makes war on the woman and her children and eats them. It's possible also to see that in this context, there's only one way to survive, and it is not negotiation. It's just not negotiation. It's hupomene. It's faithful endurance. In mm-hmm. other words, in my mind, I see them crouching under the table in Revelation. So when I think mm-hmm. of Romans 13, that's what I think of as an alternative. You know, how can we survive Rome?
Right. It's just so strange, though. Paul talks so much about powers and principalities, and talks about, you know,
yeah.
the triumphal procession that he's leading them all in, Jesus leading them all in humiliation, right?
Yep.
You know, also referencing Caesar's
yep.
processions.
Yeah.
It's just weird then to see him say here, you know, obey them because they're from God. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, but you've said elsewhere that they're in rebellion against God.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's by virtue of the cross that they have been triumphed over and their power destroyed. So I don't know. Is this one of those passages where people wonder if it's an interpolation, a later interpolation or something?
Josh, those kind of assessments are desperation.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering if there was any kind of scholarly consensus on it, right? But yeah, absolutely. It seems like a direct contradiction.
Althea knows there are other passages that seem not to have been part of Pauline narrative. I'm thinking of the passages about subordination of women in
right.
is it 1 Corinthians or something? Those passages right. might be misplaced. But the problem at the end of Romans seems to be where it ends. Mm-hmm. We don't know where it ends. I mean, it looks like it ends in 15. So if it ends in 15, could it end somewhere else? Could there be different versions of Romans going around copied in antiquity? Could 16 have been added on as a way of identifying people in the Roman community? See what I'm getting at? So because it's so near the end, you know, 14 is just before 15, which seems to end, is it possible that it could have been added? Yeah, I don't know. That would be the most I would concede on the question of cutting out bits I might not like.
On the other hand, I'm sitting here thinking about dancing. when you begin to look at what seems to be contradictions, I wish I were Twinkly Toes. It's almost like dancing is a strategy. So when you're discussing this topic, are you on tippy toes? When you're discussing this topic, do you turn to rap dancing? When you go to the other topic, are you doing ballet?
Yeah.
And so what are the issues? How do we use these texts to even understand what are the issues at and what's at stake with each issue that's being described? Because then it seems and I really feel hypothetical at this point, but it seems like layers within the letter that are about different things that require different moves at different points. So if you're wanting to survive the government, then here's what we do in this time. We give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God's what is God's.
Mm.
If we're looking at how community behavior attracts or deflects imperial gaze or even reflects imperial gaze, then we get it together internally to see how we live with each other and actually how we survive the time while maintaining the lordship of Jesus Christ. So that's kind of why I'm beginning to feel like a dancer. Yeah. But it really, I know it's not an apt metaphor for what's going on, but I'm wondering if it could be a useful metaphor for discerning different pockets in Rome, in Romans, and even canonically.
It fits with the Song of the Sea, which is with hand drums and dancing. Yeah.
Now that we have overcome, it's boogie down time.
So I guess we should be prepared for all different kinds of dancing at different points.
Yeah, I completely agree. It just seems it's a bit like imagining, you know, Moses. To refer back to that, you know, like singing this song of triumph over Pharaoh, and then turning around and saying, "But be sure to submit to Pharaoh because you know he's from God." It's like, what is going on here?
But you know, I'm thinking when I look at the readings all together and see how we have focused on Romans 4:14 and where our discussion has gone up about the fragile community, which is an image that I'm taking very seriously. The fragile and vulnerable community. When I look back at the Genesis narrative, as much as I have in former times expressed my sympathy for the grassroots Egyptians who are suffering because of the doings of their overlords, nonetheless, in this moment, and maybe I am dancing, but nonetheless, in this moment, for a church whose heritage is this lectionary, that puts together in bewildering and puzzling ways passages that don't seem to match. When you think about empire in Romans, empire in Revelation, the power and might of the empire, what does it say to the church? Whether you're reading Exodus 14, 19 to 31, or 15b, 1b to 11, 20 to 21, what does it say about the power of this particular God to overcome not only other gods, but their political representatives as well? So this is a history of our confidence that when we have to huddle together as people who are afraid of the might that is around us and our own internal strife, brother to brother, these are things that in fidelity to this particular Lord who has chosen us and whom we have chosen, then we can be confident to follow a certain path, because the ultimate outcome is in this conquering God's hands, our conquering God.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I like giving you the last word, Althea.
Well, may it only be the last word that opens us back to this whole discussion.
Okay, good. So we'll pause there and we'll continue another time. And I will thank you both immensely.
Thank you, Tuja.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a good and successful and safe teaching, preaching, and experience of the week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.